Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, you are listening to Just Films and That. This is the podcast where we talk about films we think might be underrated, underseen, or sometimes we just want to talk about them. I'm the host for this week, Josh Hallam, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host and friend, Alice Oliver. Alice, you all right?
Am I? You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, I'm all right. Well, you know, I'm excited, though, don't you?
Oh, gosh, again? What have we said about this, Josh? Well, while we're recording...
Not that.
Put a lid on it. Oh, not that. Oh, you. Thank goodness. Why are we excited this time?
I'm excited for the usual reason I'm always excited, apart from that, in fact, that I get to jump on record a podcast with you, is that we're joined by another wonderful guest. He's a writer, comedian, a podcaster in his own right. Stuart Laws, how are you doing, sir? Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. This is lovely.
Doing all right?
I'm doing fine, I'd say. I've been ill, but I'm not going to complain about it like you did pre-record.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we did have to move the record because I wasn't feeling well. So thank you for that. thank you very much for coming on. We're going to talk about a film of your choice, which we'll get to in a minute. But before then, whenever we have a guest on, we tend to have a random question from one of our listeners just to warm up, Alice, just to stretch before the run.
I'm freezing. I need to warm up.
You need to get the lactic acid question onto flowing. The question is from Ashley over on X, formerly known as Twitter, of course. If you were suddenly a pro boxer or wrestler, you can pick whichever of the two. Even in your current condition?
Yeah, especially in my current condition. Could be my little tag team partner.
What would your entrance song be?
Sorry, Stuart, I'm heavily pregnant is what that was.
I was trying to work out what it was.
What the current condition could have been, just to
handcuffed
ease your
to
mind.
Another person, and it's going to make a buddy comedy out of it.
So that could have been some weird thoughts going through your head there. My entrance, you know what? Every time I sort of get poised this kind of question, and it's the same, the answer is the same as like, what would your stripper song be? But it's Supermassive Black Hole by Muse. It's just that intro, man. It's like, it's unmistakable. It's powerful. It's like 0-60 in a split second sort of thing. I wouldn't describe myself as a huge Muse fan. I like Muse. Like, they're clearly very good and very talented. And, you know, I don't mind listening to them. But that song just absolutely bangs. And I feel like that would, you know, people would know that you'd arrived, I reckon. So, yeah. I'd definitely go Supermassive Black Hole by Muse. What about you, Josh? What would yours be? I'm really intrigued to know, actually, what sort of thing you're going for.
I don't know. I mean, part of me wants to go stupid and throw everyone off and just go with, like, Goodbye, My Lover by James Blunt. Bring it down. Let's get mellow as I walk out, and then everyone has a bit of a cry. And then maybe I could catch my opponent off guard.
Okay.
You'd be like, did I disappoint you when I knocked you out?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Be like, oh, it started. I was sorry. I was thinking about my ex. Bang.
That's good. I like that. That's really good.
Yes, that's what I would go for, something to catch people off guard. What about you, Stuart? Obviously, as a comedian, sometimes you get to pick the music you walk on to. What would you pick?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about it. So normally when that happens is you just go, just put something upbeat.
Yeah,
because I've made the mistake before of putting on songs that I like, and then it sort of creates this vibe of... real bleakness. That weirdly, me coming out and doing jokes, people aren't like, oh, thank God the bleakness has been punctured. They're just like, the vibe's wrong now.
Oh, no.
But if I was to go big, and I'm a wrestler in this situation, I just have to come out with Breaking the Law. But Yeah. So it would basically be saying to whoever I'm up against is like, there's a strong chance you could be breaking the laws of wrestling. So think about what you're doing before Stuart Laws comes in and breaks your skull. I don't know what whether you're allowed to break skulls in wrestling.
Let's see you are in this scenario.
Go for it.
Who sings that? I don't know. I don't think I know that song. I'm not
Judas Priest.
Breaking the law. You've heard it.
Well, as the song is playing, yeah, they're like breaking the law. I'd have a mic and I'd go at the end of every law.
Terrifying. Terrifying. Yeah. I'd be quaking in my boots. Oh, that's a good one. I love that.
I'd get some money through box office, that I reckon.
Yeah. I'm doing a door split as well, so that's key.
Okay, let's move on to talk about this week's film then, which is Unbreakable from 2000. So, spoiler warnings if you've not seen a 24-year-old film, but, you know, some people haven't, so there we go. So, Stuart, you picked this one. So tell the guys at home a little bit about what it's about and why did you pick it for the podcast, apart from the fact that we asked you to come on?
The film Unbreakable is one that has lived with me ever since I first saw it in the cinema. I was, you know, a big fan of The Sixth Sense. And was like, oh, wow, this is exciting. You know, I was a teenager at the time. And then in Unbreakable, I was like, oh, great. This is such a fun, stupid, but like exciting sort of spin on a superhero movie. Mm. I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed the filmmaking. And it's very much the least known, I think, of the M. Night Shyamalan's, including sort of, you know, when he went off the deep end. So, well, actually, literally, because Lady in the Water was him going off the deep end into a swimming pool of chaos. But, like, even the bad ones of his are sort of more well-known for, like, the bad bits.
Mm.
And so Unbreakable seems to just be sat in that sweet spot of not being, I'd say, in the same way that The Prestige is for Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
it sort of really is just like, really it doesn't have that big pop that a lot of the other films have, so it goes unnoticed. Yeah, unnoticed.
So would you say it's underseen then?
I think it's underseen.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think that's a really good point about M. Night Shyamalan's filmography. It's sort of like, first of all, he became known as like a thriller horror guy. So then obviously The Sixth Sense was his big massive hit, and then he went on to make this, but then after that he made a few other things that like didn't really land, like you say, like Lady in the Water. Did you, The Village as well, was that him?
Yeah, and Signs. So Signs was his like big budget one after, but then again people sort of hated that for the ending, so they were like, he's a master at sort of PR and like promoting these films, and the trailers were always like, the trailer for Unbreakable I think is just so perfect, and it sort of ticks perfectly into my like sense of mystery. Like it goes, here's the mystery, there's a train crash where there is only one survivor and he's miraculously unharmed, and you're like, yeah, okay, I want to know what's going on here. That is absolutely and like the tone of it, it's like a single shot pushing in on Bruce Willis sat there. I'm like, this is the exact film I want to see. And Signs, I remember the trailers for it were so good. The Village, again, the trailers were so good that that's in a way he's too good at that when the film doesn't deliver, people get annoyed.
Because this has been his direct follow up to The Sixth Sense as well, wouldn't it? So the pressure must have been on here because he was sort of becoming known as the twist guy.
Yes, exactly. Right. And there's even there's a moment in it where and it's actually sort of my least favorite bit of the film when the mother of Elijah gifts then her teenage son a comic book and says to him, I hear this one has a twist ending.
Yeah.
And you're like, come on, Em.
And they both look at the camera like,
yeah.
Maybe that'll come back round.
And it also even is like, the shot is like an aerial shot of the comic. And as he picks it up and spins it around, the camera spins around with it as well. So it's like the camera's twisting at the same time. It's just like, come on, you're getting high on your own supply here.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. Alice, then. So had you seen this one before?
So I had not seen it before, but I was aware of it, and I thought I was very much aware of the concept. Where, you know, I knew about the sort of the train crash element of it, that he was the sole survivor. I didn't quite realize that. So is it actually based on a comic book, or does it just take on not? But I didn't realize how much of a sort of air quotes superhero film it was, and how it does sort of hit all those beats, and it is kind of more like that. I thought maybe it was just like, oh, just this random dude survived a train crash, we don't really know why, sort of thing. Hilarity ensues or whatever it is. So no, hadn't seen it before. I reckon you probably had seen this before, Josh.
So I saw it back in the days of renting videos and DVDs. Oh, yeah. I think I rented it when I was about 12 or 13, and I think I pretty much was sold on, like you said, Stuart, the trailer. And this is at a time when superheroes weren't in the cinema four times a year. So as a little sort of comic booky nerd, being a bit like, oh my God, like an actual, like a superhero, like he's got powers and stuff. Yeah, well, that's definitely going to be good. And then I got it. And I remember enjoying it, but I think I was probably a little young to fully grasp how good it actually was and how well made it was. And I think I was just very much just drawn in by superheroes. And there's quite a lot of films that I have watched when I was probably a little young, in terms of, not in terms of, like, you know, being scared or anything like that, but more in terms of grasping the quality of the film, because Empire or Total Film said they were good.
Yes.
And I was 12 and going, well, obviously if they say it's good, it's not good. It's good even. So I think there's quite a few, like, I still need to go back to, definitely mentioned this before, like, I still need to go back to The Life Aquatic, the Wes Anderson film, because that got 5 stars. So I went in as a 13-year-old being like, it's going to be like Liar, this. It's going to be just proper comedy. And then not really obviously grasping the subtlety of it and you know, that style, because it's, you know, just being a little young. So had seen
it
before.
I think that film would be better, Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, if at the end Steve Zissou just goes, it was me. Because I genuinely think they let Steve Zissou get away with it in that film. They are in love with the character, and he's a bad man. And like, that's my, I don't like it, really, of all the Wes Andersons.
I mean, I haven't
seen it. Not to distract.
No, but I haven't seen it since then. Not because I've just never gone back to it. I don't mind Wes Anderson. He's not my favorite director. You know, he makes very, very well, very well-made films, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But when you see 5 star and the genre's comedy, and you're 13, your 13-year-old brain's sort of going like, oh yeah, Dumb and Dumber. Yeah,
yeah. Here we go.
Something like, oh, there's going to be so many good knob jokes in this, and then it's like, oh, a subtly made comedy about, like, you know, isolation or what, you know, whatever it's about. But no, anyway,
a Portuguese sort of Bowie covers.
I had seen a breakup before, but not since then. So probably, you know, coming up for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was really excited when you picked it. I was really excited to go back to it then. So come back to you now then, Stuart, then. So what do you like about it then? What particularly drew you to it, apart from the trailer, obviously?
So definitely when, as a teenager, like the things that I really loved about films and TV were like mystery box sort of things. So things like Lost, like Twilight Zone, X-Files, that was like where it basically just says, here's a mystery, now let's try and, you know, it's tantalizing mystery, let's try and solve it. And so I didn't know anything going into the film when I watched it, so the superhero thing was such like a surprise element to it. And I think I watched it twice at the cinema, and then got it on, you know, special edition DVD, and then have watched it, I'd say, at least once every couple of years, few years since then, which is, yeah, it's 24 years now. So I've definitely watched it over 10 times.
Wow. So real rewatchability factor for you then. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I'd say this is the longest I've not watched it for a while. I'd say it's probably like five, six years maybe since I've last watched it. I love the tone it creates. Like, it has such, like, it hangs in the air, and this somberness to it that the sort of the David Dunn character has, of this sadness, this like longing to sort of be able to push beyond what has happened in his life, and, like, you know, all of like the best intentions of how his life has ended up, you know, where it is, and feeling like there's no way out, and then suddenly sort of being able to confront you know, a potential new reality for him, a new way forward. I think that sort of, that tone sort of really weirdly struck with me even as a teenager. Like, there was like, I guess I was a sad teenager, as I guess 99% of them are. But then sort of the way that it's visually done and the way it's grounded within this sort of like humdrum life, but with this super, you know, hyper reality elements to it. I think just, I couldn't comprehend that that was what you could do with storytelling, that you could ground something so fantastical within what is essentially a family drama about, you know, a divorce, a breakup, and a couple trying to sort of navigate that. And so, yeah, like the way that it's visually shot really excited me, that seeing an actor like Bruce Willis do that sort of performance that he did in it, the way that Samuel L. Jackson sort of ground his sort of frankly absurd character that you sort of 100% believe that that could be a real person, the sort of subtle humor to it, the music, the score of it is incredible. I remember listening to that lots. There's a track called The Orange Man, which is like the one of the climactic fight scenes, which I really love. And then even just sort of like the genre adhering elements to it, sort of like the action scenes, the, you know, the dents in the wall from the superhero thing, the framing shots of the poncho and the, you know, the cape, the superhero cape, and even like the freeze frames at the end, which I know gets some derision, where it's like, Elijah Price was committed to a criminal, an asylum for the criminally insane. Where I just am like, you're adhering to like the genre, like classics, like what you should do, but it sort of makes it feel sort of quite absurd within the framing of a domestic drama, very humdrum, low key. And I just sort of love that sort of juxtaposition to it.
It's very comic book, that as well. I'd completely forgotten about I remembered most of it, but I could not remember the end panel bit, you know, with the, like you said, the he was committed to an asylum or whatever it says at the end. But that's quite comic book, like when you read comic books, that's that they'll just be like, and then the Joker got arrested, or whatever. So I think, and also there's an element of that, of he's playing with you a little bit, I think, there, because he's sort of going, oh, maybe it's real, you don't know. And it's like, obviously it's not real.
100%, because that's what you do for like films that are based on reality, like real stories. You do that, like sum up a few panels. So it's just sort of selling that. And, you know, like the scene where his son wants to shoot him is such a funny, ridiculous scene, but it played so straight that, like, but then by the end when they settle and they all just sat on the floor separate from each other, this sort of like, the family further apart than ever, because the son is desperate for the dad that he wants, but that David Dunn isn't being, basically.
I mean, it's incredibly tense, that scene. I just want to go back to something you said earlier, because I'm really interested to know. So when you went to see this in the cinema, all you'd seen was the trailer, you didn't know anything about it.
The glory days before the internet was really...
I think something's been lost a little bit in recent times. So I am a comic book film fan, and I've tried my best to mute everything to do with it, but I feel like I'm going to go into Deadpool 3 or Deadpool and the Wolverine knowing everything.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? You're already finding out, like, oh, they asked this person and they couldn't do it, which obviously, if you know how films are made, you're going, well, who else have they asked then? Because that means they've probably done this and this and this. And before you know it, you're pulling on mad threads. And I do think something's probably been, not to sound like it was a better in the old days type of person, because I'm not, but I do think something has been lost with the sheer amount of content that needs to be generated, that you just constantly see and stuff on the internet and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it was because there was like, you know, only a few ways of being promoted these films, like the printed press, where you couldn't spoil a huge amount, or you could just choose to read the first paragraph or, you know, whatever. But now constant social media being pushed to your phones, sort of with like clickbaity sort of like, you won't believe who cameoed in there, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And, you know, all of the, or like, you know, I loved the most recent Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, part one. But in hindsight, I watched that making of that they posted like four times because it just, I thought, how exciting that Tom Cruise is jumping off of fucking.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cliff with the motorbike and parachuting, but then that means that in the film the whole scene is built up in a way that you don't know what he's going to do and what where Benji's leading him. So then when he, but you're like, when you know that, you just go, oh, he's going up the, he's going to do that bit that I've seen,
the big stunt. Yeah, it's sort of, it forecasts it a little bit for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's the same with, like, I've always thought, how amazing would it be to see Jurassic Park knowing nothing about the film? Where you're, because it's made in a way that's supposed to be like, oh, what is this? This is odd. Slow creep, and then to be able to have the same moment that Alan Grant and Ellie Sattler have of seeing them for the first time would be incredible.
Yeah, I've always thought the same thing about The Matrix. I'd love to have been there opening night in The Matrix and people be like, what is this?
Yeah.
And to be able to be like, you know, drink it all in terms of that and anything. So I definitely think something's been lost in the inexperience there. But anyway, Alice then. So you were the only one who hadn't seen this before then. So I think we'd be both desperate to know, what did you think? What did you like? What didn't you like? What did you reckon to it?
I think that so many elements of this film are really excellent. And it was so much better. Not that I didn't think it was going to be good or anything, but I think I got so much more out of it than I was expecting to. Some of the things that I liked about it, Stuart's already touched on there, but just the general execution of the concept and the story that has been written around this character, I just found absolutely fascinating. Like, in so many ways, it doesn't feel like a superhero film, but it is hitting all those superhero beats. And the realization of David's powers feels really gradual and unremarkable and unceremonious. And it just really feels like what would happen if you really started to realize these things about yourself, like how he just goes to his wife and is trying to figure out, well, when was the last time I was ill or I was injured? And they're just stood in a doorway and have this pretty mundane conversation about it as they try to figure out the times, you know, oh, have I ever been ill or have I ever been injured or whatever? And it all just feels so normal and so natural. And I love that this is the general vibe that the film is going with, and especially watching it now in 2024, given everything that we've been given when it comes to superheroes and now what we do expect. It just felt like quite a unique viewing experience. And then when you think of the way that we're presented with certain scenes and scenarios, so like the home invasion scene, right? So there's actually something quite terrifying about how mundane and normal the whole thing seems to be. And it's not too dissimilar, I thought, to something like Funny Games. So like there's no big explosions, no dramatic score. He just walks into someone's home, finds these two kids tied up with their parents dead, and just deals with it the best way that he can. And instead of having like a gang of heroes swoop in and save the day, or a brightly costumed hero relishing in bringing down the bad guy, he just chokes him to unconsciousness. And it feels like he does this for a very uncomfortably long time. And the primal energy that fills the scene is what adds the terror and the horror to it. And just a tiny little quick spoiler for Man of Steel here. So if you haven't seen it, pause now, skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want that to be spoiled. But just give you a couple more seconds now. But part of what I find most impactful about Superman killing Zod is that he just snaps his neck to do it.
Yeah.
Like, there's no laser beam eyes. He hasn't moved a building and dropped it on top of him. There's nothing really that supernatural about it. It's just raw and visceral. And I felt like this had that similar energy throughout. I thought it was really good.
I love that.
Okay, so just a few other things that I liked about it. So from a technical point of view, like the camera work, the framing, the use of shadow and blocking, and the editing is all really effective. The music, like you said, Stuart, the music is great, but it's also used really sparingly. And quite often you are left to sit in the silence, which is a technique that I really enjoy. Like the film doesn't feel the need to bombard you with just, you know, song after song. And it's like, oh, we need to make this scene feel, you know, tense or exciting or whatever. So we're going to use this music. It just kind of lets you sit there with the characters a lot of the time. I love the relationship between David and Audrey. I think it feels really mature and real and tender. And I think the performances across the board are really, really strong as well. And there's a real intentional and interesting use of colour throughout with regards to certain objects and costumes seen in the frame, which I thought was really interesting. And then just finally, so most of the film, it does sort of feels like it moves at quite a slow pace, especially if you are going to compare it to, you know, more modern kind of action superhero type films. So it means that certain moments really do stand out. So obviously I mentioned the home invasion sequence, which, you know, was really, really sort of had a high impact on me. But the other one, and you mentioned this just before, Stuart, but it's when David's son brings the gun to the dinner table, right? Like, because he's going to shoot his dad. And I did not see that coming. Like, it was such a weird turn in the movie. I was just like, whoa, holy shit, where's that come from, sort of thing. And I found it genuinely shocking. Like, it had such an impact on me. And it's like, but again, no big loud music. It's not like this huge action piece or whatever going on, but it's just, I think that image of a young child holding a gun at his dad is quite horrifying in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because he believes in him.
To like. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh, I mean, I kind of believe in him too, because the film is called Unbreakable. So I do think you're right, kid. But Jesus Christ, like, let's not this be the test. Like, he's gone to the most extreme version of what you could do. It's like, just smack him around the head with a shoe or something and just see what happens. Like, you don't need to shoot the fella. But yeah, so much to like in that. I just thought it was such a well-made film in so many ways. What about you, Josh? What were some of the things that you liked about it?
I mean, you've both touched on mostly what I would say, but yeah, I mean, just to go back to the way it looks and the way you feel and it feels when you're watching it. I mean, it feels really comic booky. I know that, you know, sort of should go without saying, but it's obviously going for a real specific comic book aesthetics. Like you say, it's got a real distinct sort of blues and purples color palette throughout, which is when you read comic books, certain, you know, whoever inks it, whoever draws it, they will have distinct art styles. And that's what it felt like they were going for. And this, I thought, you know, I really like that. The camera work as well, I'd never really noticed just how voyeuristic and point of view it is. There are lots of times when you're seeing conversations, it's as if you're spying on the conversation. So it's not, you're not meant to see it. And I think there's an element of that with comic books as well, where you're obviously seeing people that, you know, you see both sides of a person's identity. And I think I think that's really interesting the way they do that. There's almost elements of it at the beginning, you know, for example, when he's on the train coming back before the accident, you realize you've watched that whole first sort of 10 minutes as a little girl. So it's a little girl just spying on their conversation, isn't it? And it does the same thing with the scene with the gun at the dinner table, where almost like you could be a second kid watching that. It's like you're sat at the table, the way the cameras operate and stuff like that. So I thought that was really interesting in terms of applying it as a comic book film, you know, and that idea of voyeurism, and you're not really meant to see, no one else gets to see Batman and Bruce Wayne, you get one or the other sort of thing, but you get to see both, and that's your sort of God's eye view type thing. So I really enjoyed that. Narratively as well, I thought it was really, really strong. I did think it was well paced, not too much exposition as well. They don't really go too much into it and stuff like that. There's a lot of show, don't tell. So like at the beginning, woman sits down and he obviously fancies her, so he takes his wedding ring off. Whereas, you know, if this was a show now, it'd be 15 episodes and there'd be 2 episodes on why he was so unhappy.
Oh, man. Yeah.
and then all you got to do is show and take his wedding ring off. You know what he's doing. He's obviously going to try and chat her up or whatever. So, yeah, really enjoyed that. And then just finally, this is obviously the first Bruce Willis film we've done since obviously finding out about his illness and stuff like that. And it made me quite sad to watch it. But at the same time, he's such a force as a leading man. And he's really great in this. He's so stoic and emotionally repressed, which is a real credit to his range, because really, I think of his characters more as the John McClane outgoing, assertive, yes, sarcastic type. Whereas in this, he's the complete opposite of that. And you don't, you know, I just think he's, it should be said, he really did have a great range as a leading man. And he's really great in this.
So that, like, the tone and the volume of his voice pretty much doesn't change.
It's like ASMR at places,
the whole
isn't it?
Thing. Yeah, it's so interesting. I was like, no matter what situation he finds himself in, he just maintains the same thing all the way through. And I bet that is really challenging in its own way, because obviously when there's certain things happening around you, especially, you know, more dramatic things or dangerous things, like when he's being the security guard and he sort of senses that the guy has a gun and all that sort of thing, your sort of natural instinct as an actor might be to react to that in a certain way. And every time he's just like, he stays down here. He's like, oh yeah, that guy's got a gun. He's like, oh, my son tried to shoot me. Like, it's all on one level. And it's just so fascinating that that's how he played it, or that's how he was directed to play it. And again, totally flying in the face of the sort of the superhero type thing that you always like, don't worry, everybody, I'm here to save the day and all that sort of thing. Like, he's just not that at all, which is why it's so interesting as a superhero film. It's just so different from like any other superhero film I've seen.
I find it that performance, I love so much. And and it's so smart to be using Bruce Willis in that way. And I know that obviously they had the prior relationship, but like, to take it as that, it's Neville and Robin Wright Penn's, when she comes up to say that she wants to give it another go, and it just holds behind him as she just delivers that, and that there isn't like a big, like, cathartic, like, yes, we're doing it again. It's just like he sort of silently accepts it, and then she silently accepts that, and then he closes the door. And you're like, this is just, I hadn't seen like that sort of stuff done in like a film that is essentially supposed to be a big blockbuster. But these sort of mature relationships being explored in that way. I thought it's fantastic. And both of them are so good in that moment. And I think it did change superhero movies after that. And it sort of introduced those elements that probably, I'm not saying that Nolan was like directly influenced by it or sort of thing, but like, you know, that seems like it paved the way where Nolan's Batman was like, could be seen as commercially viable in the aftermath of that film doing as, it didn't do as big as Sixth Sense, but it did very well for what would have been a mid-budget film, you know, without any massive special effects, no huge action scenes or anything like that.
Okay, so we'll move on to talking about the things that we didn't like about Unbreakable or anything we might change about Unbreakable. I'll come to you first, Alice, then, because this, again, first time watch. Is there anything that you would change about Unbreakable or make longer? Not make longer, sorry, or make different? Would you make it longer?
Yeah. The whole thing, longer. Yeah. Another hour of Unbreakable, please. So there are two things. So one of them is something that I really didn't like and would just get rid of completely. And the other thing is something that didn't really bother me, but I could certainly see how it wouldn't fly with some people. So the biggest offender for me in this is the amount of cross dissolves and fades to black, right? So this is just my personal preference, but I'm really not into these sort of transitions. Like, the amount of wipes that we get in something like Star Wars is laughable to me and really affects my immersion of the film. And I always associate it with the editor or the director being uncertain about how we move from one scene to the next. So I just found them unnecessary for the most part. And they kind of made me laugh, but for all the wrong reasons. And there was quite a few of them in there. So that was the main thing for me. So real small potatoes. Like, it's not going to ruin the enjoyment of the film for me, but when I see it, I'm like, oh, God. And the other thing is that I do feel like the pace in this is quite slow. Like, it's a bit of a slow burn, and some of the scenes go on for a bit longer than you might think they should, and some of the shots even linger for a longer time than you would expect them to. But for me personally, so I don't mind this, because I think you can really see the intent behind it, and everything is so on purpose. Like, nothing feels like it's been done by accident or that it hasn't been thought about properly. But I do wonder if for some people it is just a little bit too slow moving. Like I said earlier about being allowed to sit in the silence with the characters. I'm not sure if this is something that mainstream audiences are looking for or are getting that much enjoyment out of. Obviously, I'm not sure, but say if someone said they watched this, but at times felt bored, I would understand where they're coming from, but I didn't feel that way. But that's just something I observed.
Do you think you would have felt that way if you'd have watched it when it came out?
Definitely. So when did this come out? 2000. So I would have been like 11. Mm. So yeah, I don't.
Too young, probably.
But... yeah, I think, I do think, and like you said, Josh, when you watched it when you were quite young, you didn't quite grasp. I think because so much of the quality of it comes from quite sophisticated areas, without trying to sound too pretentious or whatever.
I think you're right. Like, that's a fair point.
It's like, it's a lot of the technical elements, a lot of the decisions that have been made around it. That's what make it impressive. It's not the big flashiness of it. It's not the explosions and the huge action sequences and all this. It's all the subtle things about it that make it good. And I don't think you can really fully appreciate that, as it, or most kids probably wouldn't be able to appreciate that. But I also think there's a certain element of maybe not quite appreciating it unless you have quite a broad spectrum of film watching experience. Like, I think the more films you've seen, the more fascinating this is because of the ways in which it is different, if that makes sense.
I also think that's funny to be, you know, like normally, like if you're like watching a video with someone or whatever, and like, you know, someone does an amazing skateboard trick or there's a cool stunt and you're like, oh, did you watch that? Like, you spot there looking at their phone or whatever. This would be like, you'd be like, hey, whoa, roll it back. Look at that pause there before Audrey responds.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's incredible.
No, I think that's a fair point. So what you're basically saying there, Alice, is Stuart was a really clever teenager.
Clearly, clearly, to be able to appreciate and grasp the quality of it and enjoy it for truly just for what it is, definitely.
Also, this is late stage. I'll offer my dislike first, and then I'll offer another thing that I like. I'd say the only thing that I dislike, I wondered whether or not I would like it less because it'd been a bit of a gap, you know. I'm an older person now. Maybe I'll look back and be like, what a silly idiot getting so obsessed with that. The only thing I'd say that detracted from it for me was that I was quite aware that my partner was not enjoying it.
Ah, right. Okay.
Oh, no.
Or like was not, you know, was finding it sillier or, you know, finding it not in the same way I was, which is fine. But I was like, ah. That's a shame.
Oh, that is difficult. That is difficult. How could you tell? What were the signs?
You know, you get it. You just get that. You get the vibe. Questions about certain bits. Mm-hmm. The reaction to the gun scene was very different. I was like, okay, it's not going over in the way that it's going over with me.
Oh no, that's so disappointing. I totally get that. Because you get excited about something and you're like, oh my God, I can't wait for you to watch this. It's amazing. I loved this when I was a kid and it's still amazing now. And just like blank. It's like, oh God.
Sometimes it's just the moment that it hits you, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
What's the next thing you said you were going to like then, Stuart?
So I guess for me, I was diagnosed as autistic last year. And there is an element of autism, which is to do with like low affective reactivity, which is where you sort of don't seem to display much. You speak in a monotone, restrict certain sort of like things about yourself. And that there's a thing called masking where you obscure, hide those elements of you from the world that are autistic because you know that the world doesn't want to have those things. And so I didn't know that that's what I was doing. Didn't know that that was the case. And, you know, there are elements of this which does marry up with an autistic experience. I'm not saying that that is what the filmmaker was intending in any way. But there are elements of that. And obviously you can't get too close to the whole, like, autism as a superpower because it's not. But like that cliche.
The accountant and all that sort of stuff.
Which I love, isn't it? But like it's still, but yeah, there are elements to it where I'm like, ah, maybe that was me as a teenager being like, what is this thing that I don't, there's something about me.
I think that's really, I don't know that's what a really, it is. Really interesting point. I think I have a very close family member who's the same, and I'd be interested to know if they thought the same thing, if they watched the film. I'd never really thought of it that way, because I wonder, I think there might be more to that, you know, based on what you've said there.
It's the first time watching it with that knowledge and being like, oh, and I did go into it wondering whether things like that would reflect back from it. And then watching it, I was like, yep, yes, there it is. Mm. There's that scene.
It might even not necessarily be intentional by the filmmakers. It could just be there is an element of comic books, which is about, you know, if you look at like things like X-Men, it's all about just being different. So you can take that as a metaphor for whatever you want, whether, you know, X-Men's very much rooted in civil rights and stuff like that, and gay rights and stuff like that. But it's just, you know, the whole being different things, you know, it's the sort of same in that sense, isn't it? So I think that's a really good point. Okay, so we'll move on to talking about the critical reception then we'll decide if it is underseen, underrated, both, neither. We'll see. So, Alice, how do you think it did ratings-wise and box office-wise?
I feel like it's got to have done pretty well. That's my inclination. I've got to say, Stuart, so this for me, this has only ever happened one time before the whole time we've been doing the podcast. But as soon as I finished watching it, I was absolutely desperate to look up the critical reception. Desperate. Because what we try and do is whoever picks the film, the other person doesn't look it up and, you know, has a bit of a guess and sort of tries to figure out where it falls. Obviously, because Josh is hosting this week, so he already knows and he'll have that in front of him. But I didn't look. But once I finished, I was just so desperate to know, because it was such an interesting and a fairly unique viewing experience. There was just something in me that was like, I need to know what people think about this film. I was like, nah, I'm not going to do it. And the only other time was with Mouse Hunt, Josh, when you hit that.
Very similar, so, films. Funny, very similar.
Interesting. Don't know what that says there, but that's interesting. I just think it's such a well-made film that if it doesn't get, like, if it's not getting at least a high seven, I'm going to be really just baffled. So, but, you know, people are weird and, are people coming out the cinema being excited about it? Like, I don't know. So what do I reckon it get? I think it has to have got at least a 7.8 or a 78.
Okay.
I would give it higher than that. Mm. I think it's better than that. I would probably give it like a low 8. Like, I'm giving it maybe an 82, 83. Because I just think the quality is there. In terms of box office, I imagine it did quite well. So you're saying this came after Sixth Sense?
Yeah, it's like its
follow-up. People obviously really like that. So they're going to see Shyamalan's name and Bruce Willis. So they're probably going, oh, well, obviously we'll go and see that too. And like Stuart said, the trailer itself had such a huge impact on you. So I reckon financially it probably did okay.
Okay.
Is my assessment.
Do you know how it did, or should we just go straight into the numbers?
Yeah, I sort of know how it did.
You did. Okay. Okay. Well, let's have a look at the numbers then. So at the time of recording, we do IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, audience, and critics, and then we average it out. So the IMDb score is 7.3. The Rotten Tomatoes audience score is slightly higher than the critics. They give it 77%, and the critics on Rotten Tomatoes give it 70%. Now, if you average those out, it's 73, or obviously 7.3 in terms of the ratings. Then, I mean, I think that's underrated.
I think that's underrated. I think this is underrated.
It's better than that. I think it's certainly better than 70. Yeah, maybe high sevens, but I think 73. I think that's underrated for me. What would you say, Alice?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, 100%. Like, I am quite surprised. I'm surprised at the critics, to be honest, on Rotten Tomatoes. I thought they'd be more inclined to give it a higher score.
Letting us down again, aren't they?
The audience. I know. Yeah, we can't trust the thing they say.
Always let us down. You can't trust a critic unless it's us. Stuart, what do you reckon to that then? Is it 73? Is that that's underrated, right? It's got to be.
It's underrated. I'm giving it 100 or 98 if you have it to sit next to my partner.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Drops it 2 points.
It gets 2% off it for that.
I think they're not liking it.
the box office wide, then, it did, worldwide, it did 250 million. Obviously, budget's not massive, so I think that's, you know, it's done well box office wise, I'd say. But
yeah,
I do wonder if people are going back to it now.
Hmm.
If you think of the age of it, I wonder if people are going back to it now. And I wonder if, you know, if this comes out even 10 years later in 2010, I think you could probably add another 100 million onto that.
I wonder if in sort of the context of other Bruce Willis films as well, if it is getting a little bit overlooked, like if people is, it's like, oh, Die Hard, oh, it's Sixth Sense. And they're kind of the ones that you think of from when he was like at his peak sort of thing. And I wonder if this one just sort of in the corner over there, just getting forgotten about a little bit. Like, are people going back to rewatch it? I don't know. I think there's probably an argument for it there.
I would say that a big amount of the $250 million, the heavy lifting there, is done by The Sixth Sense.
Yeah,
I think you could probably account for more than half of that is people who've seen The Sixth Sense and want to know what the next twisty Shyamalan film is gonna be. So for me, I'm saying underrated and underseen. What about you, Alice?
I think definitely underrated, and I think we can, I mean, financially that's pretty good, but I think there's definitely an argument that it would be underseen, especially by modern audiences, for sure.
Yeah, what about you, Stuart? Yeah, what do you reckon, Stuart?
Yeah, I'm not happy with it for the film's benefit, but for the purposes of me pitching one that's underrated and underseen. Yeah. Bam.
You nailed it. That's what we're looking for. Yeah, that's what we're looking for. You did it.
So Stuart, thank you very much for coming on. Tell the guys, what have you got going on? Where can they check out your stuff?
So I am a stand-up comedian. I'm on tour at the moment, so I will be coming around the country. I'm sort of in the middle of the tour, but I'm also, if you're London-based, filming my show in June. So just my website or my link tree or any of the socials, Stuart Laws Comedy, will be the place to go.
Where are some of the locations we are going to be after April 9th?
So April 11th I'm in Glasgow, then Edinburgh at the weekend, and then I've got Birmingham, Manchester, Cambridge, and Bath. Ooh. And I think that, and then there may be another one to book in, but and then back to London for the filming of it, which will be
excellent.
Fabulous. You're not coming to Liverpool now?
I'm scared of Liverpool.
Oh, fair enough. Most
a lot of non-Scouse comedians are, to be fair. Sure. Yeah. And you've got a podcast as well, then?
Yes, there will be film podcast with Nathan Darcy Roberts and Heidi Regan. Mm-hmm. We basically have a comedian guest, and we just, it's basically film chat with a couple of sort of loosely themed rounds, sort of mucking about, fill in the blanks on sort of, film trivia, and then pitching sequels to films that don't need sequels.
Like Unbreakable, maybe. Well, actually, it's actually got two sequels.
We're not going to mention that,
but yeah. And obviously, that'll be available wherever you get your podcasts, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Brilliant. We'll put links to all Stuart's stuff into the episode description. So click below and make sure you go see Stuart's show, check out his podcast. Thanks very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure, Stuart Laws. Thank you.
Thank you.
There we go, then, another guest episode in the bag. Unbreakable, sliding on into the underrated, underseen vault. If you like your comic book films, then go and watch what they look like before shared universes and something a little bit different, eh, Alice?
It is a little bit different. It's quite a unique viewing experience. I do want to thank Stuart for bringing that to us, because I may not have seen it otherwise.
No. And thank you, of course, for Stuart for coming on. Again, as I said when he was talking about it, make sure you check out all the stuff. I'll put links in the episodes, and I'll put some stuff out on social media when this comes out. We'll be back next week with another episode. If you'd like to get in touch with us in the meantime, it's filmsandthatpod@gmail.com, or on all the social medias if you search for Just Films and That on Facebook, Twitter, /X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. We're on there. Give us a follow and see what we're putting out there. We're on Patreon as well, so if you want a little bit of extra stuff, you want to support the podcast, click the link in the episode description, and there's loads you can get in there, and any support you can give us will be massively appreciated. We're also on the television, aren't we, Alice?
We are indeed. So every Friday from 6 p.m. you can catch us on the local TV network. So what that means is, if you live in Birmingham, Bristol, Leeds, Liverpool, or the northeast of England, you can find us on Channel 7 on Freeview. Or if you live in North Wales or South Wales, you can find us on Channel 8 on Freeview. And if you don't live in any of those regions, I'm also uploading all the videos onto Dailymotion. So if you head on over there, search for Just Films and That, our faces will pop up and you'll have a bloody lovely day. Guaranteed.
Indeed. We will see you next week. Thank you very much for listening. It's goodbye from me. Cheerio.
Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.